pull that mic down, Peter. Hi, I'm Bob Bazans. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, I'm Linda Bazans. I'm an Al-Anon. I didn't expect the mic.
I'm Peter Bazans, and I'm an alcoholic.
Bob Darrell, thank you for inviting us. Bob always talked about how glad he was to see me or to have me come. And then he gives me a host from to pick us up at the airport from Minneapolis and from North Dakota. Their familiarity with the airport was less than one would have wished. But as we saw this morning, there were actually three of them. And between the three of them, they have hosted us wonderfully. And it's been very nice. No, it was great. We have never done this before. Our first concern was that we'd have a fist fight up here in the audience, which we thought would be leave a lasting impression amongst the people to go do it. So it's going to be a little weird. I am going off the reservation a little bit. I'm kind of thinking about what I wanted to say. We're going to do 45, 50 minutes, stop for 15 minutes, and then come back for another 45 minutes. I'm not going to edit anything. I'm just going to kind of tell you how it was. And the first, what I'm going to focus on initially are the problems. So I'm not going to talk about the solution or what was the positive part, so it's going to sound a little gritty, but I'm just going to lay it out the way it was. And in processing this, and Peter is the child I had the most trouble with. He is the most like me. You would think that the one that is most like you would be the easiest. In my experience, it is the hardest. And so with that, Linda has been difficult throughout our entire marriage. All three of our children are in Alcoholics Anonymous, and the only explanation for why she ended up with the four of us is we think she was a contagious prostitute in the 13th century, and this is a karmic event for her. We have no other explanation, so that is... So my biggest problem, if you're boiling them down to family, I've had work issues where I was unproductive and wasn't able to, on a consistent basis, perform as a worker and as a producer. I was violent with my children, abusive. I'll talk more about that, but that would be one of the largest primary sort of thing. And I was pretty inattentive as a father. I'm kind of the last of the, I'm not a war baby, the men of my age and on were not as active in the home as people are today. If you compare this to how people are today, how my son is with his children, it's just extraordinary, the participation and responsibility. I was not that guy. And that will come up. Those were kind of the three major areas. As I was kind of inventorying about what I would share, I want to go back and just tell you a little bit about the 22-year-old, 23-year-old kid that showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous. I keep forgetting. I mean, you see this burnt-out old husk of a person who shows up, and you see me as a burnt-out old. You see me as an older guy who knows a lot about AA, who talks a lot, who is, I can talk about solutions a lot. I've had problems. I've had issues. I've been active in the program. And I have a familiarity with our principles, and I've tried to put them in action in our life. Almost no one here would have any sense of who I was when I came in. See, I talk about that a little bit in my story. Okay, so I was born in a middle to upper middle class family. I was born on third base. Congratulating myself for hitting the triple. I had an intact family, a father who was a successful business person, a mother who was. She'd be 100 years old today if she were living. She was a college graduate in business school. She had a tongue like a razor blade. I mean, your leg would fall off, and then you'd kind of notice that something, Her best quote was, "Bob, you're not very bright. Dress well." And I, and that has been the And I didn't even know she really said it. She had, actually what happened is we were at a dinner party at my brother's, and we were talking about this friend of ours that has this very bright child who they found reading like fifth and sixth grade math books, like a 6 or 7 year old with a flashlight in bed. And they found out that he had an IQ off. And my mother looked over and said, well, Bob, you were always very bright. You just never did much with it. That would be the comment. Now, I was a guy that, you know, when I wrote bad checks, the bank sent them to my parents. Okay. Now, I'm just trying to give you a sense of entitlement. Later, members of a country club. I had a sense of entitlement. All I wanted to do is become an adult. I had no idea of what process you went through from a child to an adult to become a productive, giving member of society. I was surrounded by people who were successful and participating, and I was the suit. I was the guy, I mean, I really was sophisticated, but enormously immature. I went away to college at 17. I was one of the youngest guys in my class. I couldn't shut my drinking down. I just gambled and drank my way through college and gave up, you know, walked out of Notre Dame middle of my senior year. Overdressed, looked good. I was a suit. And I was articulate and yet did not have a clue. I watched other people to kind of get a sense of it. When I got my first jobs, and when they put me behind a desk, I looked for the steering wheel. I had no idea what to do behind the desk. I mean, I didn't. I mean, I had no work training. I worked on construction crews for my dad, but I had, you know, just not a clue. And I remember when I went back to make amends with my first employer, he said, "You interviewed so well." I think, yeah, we interview well. There's performance is the issue. Interview, we handle interviews. And so I had two jobs very early on in the last part of my drinking. One for 6 months, left it, had a sales job. They were both catastrophes. I was unable to perform in those two jobs. I mean, just on a 1 to 10, I was a 2, and I didn't get it. I mean, I just flat didn't get it. Started to get sober, went to work for my father. That was a catastrophe. My father and I loved each other. I thought my job was to tell my dad what he did wrong. I was the biggest pain in the ass and the least contributing member in that. We did that as long as we could stand it, which was, I think, 2 years. The first 6 months we moved up to Brainerd. I worked up there. We had a little shopping center, beer joint, closed the beer joint down, and it was a gas station. And that was one of my better work periods because there was no one else to do it. I got up at 6, opened the gas station, grocery store, stocked the shelves, did the deal. Paid off my bills during that, you know, the debts that I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I had trouble, so I come back to the city. I've got about a year of sobriety. And now I'm working for my father in this business throughout the last year. I had trouble getting up in the morning. I say that in my AA talk, but I mean, I had trouble getting up in the morning. They like to have you show up at work. I mean, I am inconsistent. I don't know what to do when I am at work. My dad was not a very good trainer. I wanted to participate. I did 2 or 3 really good things in the 2 or 3 years I worked for my father. The rest of it was fluff. I was doing AA 8 hours a day. Didn't want any time anywhere. They had AA. I mean, I'm at 3-hour AA lunches. I don't want to miss anything. So I, you know, I'm out at night. I'm coming home at 1 from the, you know, 11 to 1 from the AA meeting. I'm drinking coffee all night. I go to bed. I wake up. Alarm clocks. No impact on me. I mean, I can sleep through an alarm clock for 2 or 3 hours. I don't know if that's a sleep problem, but I mean, I just want to let you know who showed up at the money spending. There has never been enough money. I am a money spender. I go to a place and they all you can eat for $2. I want $4 worth. I've been a wanting machine all my life. I was having breakfast with a grade school buddy of mine the other day. Of my high school buddies, 4 of us are in AA, 1's in Al-Anon. That would be my college roommate. I saw him I saw him on the streets. We went and had breakfast, and he said, "We were different from second grade. I can remember walking in the store with a nickel or a dime, and I'm thinking for about 15 minutes about what to do. You and Danny are up at the candy store spending a buck and a half, which I stole off my dad's dresser. We were just overspenders and over-sugarers from the moment, you know, it got going. Now, if you would have looked at me on the outside, I was the guy who had been to a pretty good school. I was dressed up. I looked like I could do the job. I had not a clue. I'm looking around. I'm trying to get a sense about how to do the job. I do not have a clue. What has turned out to be my grace in Alcoholics Anonymous is I have then, over a period of time, been able to select partners to be with. I'm a hell of a partner. I am not a good Lone Ranger. And I found the structure for me in my work life in sobriety after that. It is my opinion that a lot of us show up in life and we have computer programs which we have not yet booted up on our computer. When I became a father, I remember when Peter and I were... So I batted Peter around a fair amount like my father batted me around. Peter started to bat Daniel around. Daniel's in the audience someplace, poor baby. And I said, this crap's going to stop. And we went to a psychologist, and we spent a day in this man's work, psychologist that Peter does some work with today. And I remember him looking at me, and he said, "Were you an angry kid?" And I said, "No." He said, "I didn't think so." He said, "I think you became angry when you became a parent." And I went, "Oh, interesting. What happened to me when I became a parent? I booted up my computer program on parent." My old man, who was my hero, an extraordinary man, a man of great dignity, a man of great integrity. And in those days, you screwed up, you got whacked. You were at a friend's house, you screwed up, you might get whacked. I mean, it was, you know, teachers whacked you. I mean, it was not, this was not, you know, this is just a different, old paradigm. Not a workable paradigm, but an old paradigm. In those days, it didn't matter. So I booted that up, and all of a sudden my father started to jump through my mind and through my mouth. I'm responsible for that, not my father. But I'm just reporting to you that that computer program, I think we've got a computer program on marriage. And you don't even realize it. You're dating, and all of a sudden you plug the computer, you boot it up, and you've got much more data in front of you than you think you have. Expectations, behaviors, conditioning that you're totally unaware of. I think we've got a work program that you boot up. And so mostly what I want to say is I have to remember that when I was 24 when we had our first child. Now I am a poor work, I'm a suit. I mean, I'm a guy who'd like to become a man, and I'm an adolescent, which I don't think, I was a heavy drinker all the way, from the time I've been 13 or 14 years old, I drank my way through every situation that might have matured me, and I think I showed up in Alcoholics Anonymous at 24 with a maturation level of about a 16 or 17-year-old. And I'm so self-centered that my defects of character don't really have an impact on me, and I don't really get a sense of them until I'm in my second and third year of sobriety. Then I start to work on them, and I don't make much progress during my second and third year of sobriety, and it wasn't until my fifth and seventh year that I really turned the corner and I think manned up and became more of what you see today, when the temple was in better shape. When I did that. So I was, as a critic of how I was as a father, I had good examples. My mother and father raised seven children, sent them all to school, got them all through college, made great sacrifices. We had wonderful, Linda's parents, we had wonderful families and parental experiences. We were born on third base. We really had guidelines. I knew the best thing I've done is I know how to treat women. In my family, the death penalty was you mistreat the women in the family. That was a death penalty in my house. So that I did probably better than anything else. I was an inattentive, self-centered, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28-year-old young guy. I was treading water as fast as I knew how to tread water, trying to figure out how to make a living, and during my very early days had not a clue, and little by little, by osmosis, I started to get, that started to grow, and until I found the partnership, which I found in my third year of sobriety, and that started to grow, but there still had to be some other significant changes, which I will talk about when we come back in session two. It's been hard for me. Linda never liked to talk, and when I say didn't like to talk, really didn't like to talk. Nervous, hard, very, very hard for it, didn't do it, did it once a year. When we started to have financial troubles this time, she opened herself up and said, I'm praying for the business. I'm going to say yes to service more often so I can do that. So I've got a chance to hear her more in the last few years than I ever had. I don't like traveling with her because people like her better than me. And when I was alone, I was the center of attention, and I found that more comfortable. It's been hard for me to listen to her talk about the sacrifices that she made as my wife and as the mother of our children, especially during the early days of sobriety, how lonely she got, how Mr. AA was out saving the world and she's home taking care of the kids. So I'm at a meeting every night. All of a sudden our friends go, we're 24 and 21 years old. All of a sudden, their friends go from our college friends to these 50 and 60-year-old people. I just drag her along in that adjustment, not even asking about whether or not she wants to be dragged along. I'm just assuming that this is what she should be doing. Our children, you know, are growing up at roundups, and you know. But it's revolving around me. Level of narcissism that was invisible. I thought it's what a good AA guy did. And it's what a good AA guy does, but in the absence of doing what the good AA guy was supposed to be doing at home. I wasn't doing what I was supposed to be doing at home. And it was all I had. I'm not letting myself off the hook. I'm responsible for every bit of what happened. I'm just trying to give you a picture of who I brought to the table of Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it is not, you know, today you think that I could perform and do different things and have some accomplishments. I was a bozo without a clue, but I was well-dressed, well-behaved, and gave a good impression. So with that, I am so kind of a goofy start, but I just wanted to give you a sense of who I was as a young father in that program. The other thing that was the most disappointing is the level of self-centeredness, and it's so subtle when we talk about it in the program. When my children would have issues, it was about me. I mean, it got to be, what is Dad going to do? So when the kid got sent home from school, when the kid got arrested, it was about me. My violence, in addition to being conditioned in my growing up, in my childhood experience and flipping roles, which is not a small influence. It's a big influence. I'm responsible. I mean, once you open up your eyes, and you've got to own it, but I'm just saying it's not a small influence. I wanted an immediate solution. You know, problem, solution. I'm ADD. I don't want a process. I'm not interested in process. I want a solution. Life isn't like that. Children aren't like that. Family is not like that. And that was, so my frustration, me at the center of every stupid act that I performed was this deep self-narcissistic self-centeredness. It wasn't like I didn't love my children, but it was about me. And that is what I've tried to and have been able to, I think, alter, but that's who I was as a young parent. And she chose me.
The mic's too close? No, okay. Hi, I'm Linda Bazans. I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Wow.
A little goofy.
No, not goofy, very honest. We didn't rehearse this. We just decided we'd see where this went. And it's a good start. I didn't know I was marrying a bozo, I guess, and I thought that I thought I was marrying a mature man, and I loved him to pieces, and, you know, I knew he was alcoholic, and I knew that we would solve any problems that we had in spite of his alcoholism. So I did go in with my eyes open, but, you know, I loved when Bob said about the computer chip or booting up the computer. We have expectations around marriage, and I had my own and he had his own, and they were very, very different. They might not have been quite so different if we didn't have the problem of alcoholism, but of course we did. It was our major issue, and we had 1 week of drinking in our marriage. So we've been married 44 years this month, and we had 1 week of drinking, and we have had years of craziness from both Bob and from me and from the boys. So I come to this program. I'm 21 years old, and I come to Al-Anon because I want to look good. So I come with, you know, I don't think anybody comes to Al-Anon with the right reasons. We all want to make them okay. And then once we get them okay, we'll be okay, and then we can go about our business. I think that's pretty normal for Al-Anons. Not too many show up with either the wish to become one or with the hope to do the work. But we get them, and they got me. And so I came to Al-Anon, and I wanted sobriety. I wanted sobriety more than anything. I just didn't know what it meant. I didn't understand alcoholism. And I was a nurse working with it, but I didn't understand it. I did not understand that this is a deadly disease. I had no idea. I thought it was something we could manage. And I gave my best shot at managing this disease, and it beat me to the ground. So we're married a week. Bob has his last drink on our honeymoon. We embark on a marriage. I have expectations. He has expectations. They're totally different. Our group of friends changed dramatically from our college friends to most of my friends became people in their 40s, 50s, and 60s that we spent all our time with because that's what Bob was told we needed to do. And, you know, it wasn't that I didn't want to do that. It's just that I got real lonely in there. And he wasn't home very much. And I'm working, too, you know. We move up to Brainerd. I'm 5 months pregnant. We have our first child up in Brainerd. And during that time, I actually saw more of him because we ran this grocery store together. But when we got back, we had this little baby, about 2 or 3 months old. And Bob was, I guess, about a year and a half sober. And we moved back, and he's doing his AA. I'm going to Al-Anon. I'm going to Al-Anon to look good. But I'm going. Boy, am I going, and I'm getting angry, and I'm getting resentful. So we have this one little boy, and he's wonderful. But I feel like I'm doing it alone. And you know what? I wanted him to have sobriety. It wasn't that I didn't want sobriety. It's just that, you know, we have our selfishness, too. And I'm going to these meetings, and I can't tell people. How do I tell people my husband's going to too many meetings? When there are people in this room that are suffering abuse, financial difficulty, their lights, electricity are being turned off, they're verbally abused and beaten up, and my husband's going to too many meetings. I couldn't do it. It would have been an insult, I felt, to them. So I didn't tell anybody. I just kept getting sicker. And I had a sponsor. She was the perfect sponsor because she didn't rub my nose in it. And I think if she did, I would have been gone. But she didn't. She gave me the space to find out who I was. And she would gently nudge me. And that's the kind of sponsor I want to be, somebody who is gentle and not the 2x4 kind of sponsor. Because I would have been gone. I don't respond well with the 2x4. So, anyway, we end up having the second child, and that's Peter. And we were married 4 years, and we had Peter.
Should have stopped with Bill.
Listen, this is my turn. so we have Peter, and we didn't have abuse in our home that I would really say until probably Peter and Bill were, I'd say, 2 and 4, 3 and 5. And that's when I think things started to get out of hand. That's the hardest thing for me to talk about, because I loved my husband, and I saw what he did didn't work. And I loved my kids, and I don't think I protected them properly. And I wish I could change that. And you know what? I don't know how I would have changed it. But I wish that it wouldn't have been that way. You know what? I look, when I really inventoried this and thought about speaking, I think the thing that was wrong with me was that I thought I could handle it, and I didn't include God. I think that's the bottom line. I thought I could handle it. God was with me. God was part of me, but he wasn't everything. And he wasn't the person I relied on. I'll just do it until it gets tough, and then I'll pray. And then I'll take it back, and I'll do it some more. And it got tough, and I got crazy. I got real crazy. As time passed, Bob is getting better, and he's working on his program. And he's trying really hard to become responsible in his work life. And he made some real big changes, and he changed, you know, he made some strides, and things started to get better. And at some point there, we started dating. And so our lives started to get better, too. We started to at least have some time that we were together. We were literally like ships passing in the night. And I felt like I was raising the kids alone. And I think I felt that way because for the most part I was. I think that was the truth. He was certainly supporting us. I did work, but he was, you know, supporting us. And he was supporting me, but he was mostly concerned about his sobriety. Which I'm glad he was, because he's still sober. So, you know, you can't go back and change things, but you can just look at them. And I guess we're both talking about more of the problems than the solution right now. And then as time passed, we ended up having Daniel. And he's 11 years younger than our oldest son, and 8.5 years younger than Peter. And life just bumped along. And we had some really good times, but we had some very dysfunctional times in our lives, too. We had the program. I don't know what we would have been like without the program. We at least had people to look to. We had examples. But we had a lot of the disease. The solutions were there, and they were showing up, and they were getting stronger. But we had a lot of disease in our home. And it mostly showed up in a way toward the kids that was unacceptable, and I didn't protect them. Or I didn't do it the way I wish I had. And then, you know, I have the fear of the kids' safety, not only because I love them so much, because they're kids. I mean, you worry about your kids, don't you? You want them to be okay, and you don't want them to have tough times at school, and you don't want them to have the bumps in the road. And then what started to show up was that the first one looked like he could be alcoholic. So I'm looking at alcoholism with Bill. And sure enough, it was right. We did everything we could to sober him up, and God took care of him, and he got sober. And then we started seeing signs with Peter. And I'm like, no. Not again. And then we got another opportunity with Dan. And I was shaking my fist at that one. I didn't think that was fair. I'm glad I didn't get what was fair. I'm glad I got mercy and forgiveness and all those wonderful things. So I'm going to pass the mic over to Peter, but that's what I looked like. And that's how I coped. Those were my failures and my strengths. But I kept going to Al-Anon. And little by slowly, I learned about myself, I learned about recovery, and I got my own strength back.
Thanks, Mom, Dad. I'm Peter Bazanz, and I'm an alcoholic. I just want to start by thanking Bob and the committee as well. And the guys who picked us up at the airport have been fantastic. I want to thank Mike and Frog and John. You guys were fantastic last night, and it's such an honor to be here. It's such an honor to be here as a family as well. And, in reading the family afterward, the thing that kind of kept coming up for me is how common these issues are. And not only are they common for families, but they're more common for families in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really enjoyed your talk last night, Carla. Thank you so much for your honesty. I think that's what we share most here. So it's difficult to talk about these issues. So in looking at kind of the legacy, I know both my mother and father have been talking about kind of the abuse that happened in our family. And just to tell you a little bit of a background about me, I was a very crazy, rambunctious attention deficit child. And my mom said that they started to see signs and wonder about me later. I don't think that they ever had any doubt about where I was going to end up. I got kicked out of every single school I ever went to until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, including Montessori school. So I don't think that they had to wonder about that one too long. My father mentioned that, that I was raised in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I really was. My mother and father's sponsors were married, and I grew up in their home, and they were like godparents or grandparents to me. I grew up in AA houses. I grew up in AA conventions, and, my father's sponsees were like uncles to me. I had a lot of, I'm kind of an interesting hybrid of my parents. I have a lot of my father's defects of character, and I have a bunch of both of their strengths. But I think that that's why my father and I butt heads so much and from a very, very early age. So I started using drugs and alcohol. I had my first drink before I was 5 years old, and I got sober by the time I was 19. I never took a legal drink in my life, and I've been sober longer than I drank. I've been sober over 20 years. In that time, I've made almost every mistake that you can make. I just haven't put any drugs and alcohol in my body. And it's interesting to hear my parents talk about, getting sober so young and getting a little bit of perspective about how young they were and immature when they came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Because we don't really think about our parents that way. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 19. And I like what Cliff R. always says. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't getting rehabilitated because I was never habilitated. And Alcoholics Anonymous kind of had to teach me how to live. And I got sober in the Twin Cities, and my dad is, a circuit speaker and kind of an AA guru, and especially there. And it was interesting because my father always says in his AA talk, wouldn't it be fantastic if I was such a fantastic member of AA traveling all over the world, that when my children got this problem because of my behavior, they were not willing to come to Alcoholics Anonymous because they didn't want to have anything to do with what they would have gotten there because of the way my father had behaved. That was definitely not the case. And I was also thinking about that this morning. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I came here because it was my last option. I was going to die, I was going to end up in jail or an institution. And, the last night I drank, I rolled a car three times, got charged with 3 DWIs, and the person who's I was driving with, mother, is in the audience. And he went to jail, and I went to the hospital, and he recently died of this disease. And I've lost two of my closest friends to this disease since I got sober. But I was reading the family afterward, And it's interesting, you know, because it's kind of in these 1950s speak, and it's talking about, you know, these wives and with the wives, how they can support the husbands and, you know, how we should deal with, you know, the spiritual giant in the family. And when he comes home and says, we better get his brand very quickly before it's too late. And it was interesting because I found myself kind of identifying more as like the spouse in this, you know, because when we were children, our father was gone a lot, and he was super active in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never saw my dad drink. You know, I saw, you know, untreated alcoholism in our family. I didn't know what it was. I was a kid. I've never had any perspective on my life. My life is like this. And, you know, it wasn't until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that I actually had a choice about how I lived my life. I say in my talk, I almost left the planet without ever having met myself. And if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous, I never would have had that opportunity. So in kind of thinking about this, I think that the main thing that that I kind of take away from this, and just to kind of go back to what I was saying earlier, my father and I once gave an AA talk together. When I first got sober, I didn't have much of a relationship with my father because of kind of all of our issues. And I used to follow my dad around to AA conferences, and I was just kind of a fly on the wall. And that's, you know, I would do that once or twice a year, and that's kind of how we bonded. And we ended up going to this men's retreat in Montana, and we were surrounded by all these guys. And we ended up in a small group or something. We ended up talking about our experience and our abuse. And it just, like, everybody in our group started crying. And I think that then it kind of hit me how much, you know, fathers and sons pass on this legacy. And not only this legacy of alcoholism and this legacy of abuse or the legacy of failure or all the things that can be byproducts of Alcoholics Anonymous. Those have been legacies, you know, to one extent or another, passed down on my father's side of the family for four generations now. For four generations that we know of, my father's fathers have been alcoholics. Now we have an opportunity to have a new legacy. And that's a result of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's already started in our family. My older brother, Bill, has two children. He's the most incredible father that you could ever imagine in a million years. He is so present with those children and so loving, and there is absolutely no abuse in that family. And, you know, and that's a result of my mother and father as well. So, you know, and if it wasn't for, you know, my father's recovery and my mother's recovery, we probably wouldn't have this. We wouldn't have this opportunity. I think that that's the thing that you know, gives me hope. And we've definitely had a lot of issues, you know, since I got sober as well. You know, I think once I got sober, like my dad said, I kind of plugged in the adult tape. And, you know, I thought that how an adult processed issues, you know, with my girlfriends is, you know, you're angry and you're loud and you assert yourself. And, you know, I've had to face my own anger issues in sobriety and, you know, my own issues in communicating in relationships. And that's been tough. And through sobriety, I went, you know, kind of through this you know, up and down cycle where I was way too angry and assertive to way too passive, and then finding like this middle place where I'm supposed to honestly communicate my feelings in a loving and open way, you know, which is not easy, you know, and sometimes I do it better than others. I've also, you know, have the same spending issues that my father has, and that's caused a lot of issues in our relationship as well. And about 5 years ago, I ran up an enormous debt on a credit card, and my father had to come, you know, bail me out of it in sobriety, and it almost broke up our relationship as a result of it. I mean, my father felt betrayed and like I had taken advantage of him. And, you know, like I said, I've had numerous issues in sobriety. And my mother always says in her Al-Anon talk that the greatest thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that when we find ourselves in trouble or when we find ourselves down, we turn the laser on ourselves instead of turning the laser on each other. And if it wasn't for the fact that we all kind of had our own individual programs in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know if we would have made it. I also read this book, and I was really moved by Carla's talk last night. And you talk about the legacy. And when I walked in the room and I saw my friend's mother who's here, and we lost him, you look at that legacy that I was talking about of pain. And Carla's father doesn't have to worry about where Carla is anymore. And, you know, I've seen that with my friend's mothers, you know, who sit there and have to worry day in and day out where their son is, where their daughter is, and what's going to happen. And I might have made a ton of mistakes in sobriety, but my mother didn't have to sit and wonder and worry about where I was for the last 20 years. And the last night I drank, she hadn't heard from me for 3 days and was sick and couldn't sleep. And, you know, so that's a legacy that we don't have to pass on anymore as well. And that's, you know, that is not only debilitating to families, you know, but it obviously affects society as a whole. You know, our communities, there's such a trickle effect of that. When one person is taken out of the family and removed, everybody feels like something's missing, and they know it, and they're not complete. And we had three chances to not be complete, to have something go catastrophically wrong in our family. And I think about that. Like, what if one of us was still out? What if there was, you know, the tragic story of one of us who was still out there, you know, not getting the solution? And we've been so blessed to have, obviously, this disease, which they were reading a little bit about, you know, from that excerpt from the family afterward, where our deepest, darkest secrets become our greatest assets. And to me, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, and we're able to share that with each other, and something miraculous happens. So I'm really grateful to be here today. Thank you.
We're going to take a 15-minute break. We're going to come back, and we'll talk a little more about the solution and how it is today. Thank you.